Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Business Game Changers, I'm Sarah Westall. Today we have a really interesting show lined up. I have Roxanne Meadows. She is the co-founder of the Venus Project. They have put together documentaries, films, they have a research facility. They've had over 50 million people watch their documentary that they recently put out in 2016. They're hitting a nerve. They've had millions and millions of people watch their documentaries after the internet started booming and they really started to reach people. And I wanted to talk to her about what the Venus Project does and what they're about. And just to give you a little hint, they are working on creating a different structure for society, not socialism, communism, capitalism, or any other, you know, ism or structure that you've heard of, but a new modern way to structure society so that we can evolve and everybody can be prosperous and have abundance. It's a complete paradigm shift. They've won awards from the UN. They've won multiple awards. And, you know, it's really difficult to understand coming from our environment without really diving in deep and learning and listening and reading and trying to understand their paradigms, because at first glance, it's hard to see how it could work. But if you give it a chance and you listen to it, there are ways that this can work, I believe, but not necessarily with what we have going on, not necessarily with what all the dysfunction and the dysfunctional people we have. It's a pretty long process to get anywhere near what they're talking about. But I think it provides a beacon of what maybe we can get to. So before we get into that interview, I'm going to play clip from their documentary, their trailer, and then we're going to get into the interview with Roxanne Meadows. Hi, Roxanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
You have an amazing project going on. You've done a lot of documentaries. You've written books, and you're really trying to get the information out there. It's called the Venus Project. Can you explain what that is?
I'll try and do that. Well, first of all, we feel what we need in society is a direction. It does not have a direction. We're trying to fix things within the confines of our existing system that we live under, and we feel that that system causes the problems in the first place. Essentially, we're fighting the detrimental causes by the established society, which has far outlived its usefulness, considering what things could be like. And this is what we represent, and this is what we try to show. The Venus Project proposes a totally new, holistic, socioeconomic system. It's not socialism, communism, free enterprise system, fascism, or nothing that's gone before. It's a global approach to the social reclamation of the environment, our structures, and people as well.
So basically it's about growing up, evolving as a society?
Yes, in many ways, we think so.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the main aim, though, is the well-being of people and the protection of the environment.
Well, you have a research center dedicated to this. What do you do? It's pretty big, right? And what do you do?
Well, I'd like to go on a little bit more, if you don't mind, about what this is.
Oh, that's fine. Go ahead and then get into more research. And then what I was wanting to do was talk about the problems that you're trying to solve and then circle back to the Venus Project again.
Sure. Okay. But I just wanted to mention, it also uses the methods of science applied to the social system, as opposed to the way we do things today by using opinions and politics and money and people who have advantage. Or do you want to cover this afterwards? this aspect of it.
Well, I want to cover, you know, what the Venus Project is, but then I want to cover the problems that you're trying to address and what you've identified, and then circle back to how you're planning on solving them. I wanted to just touch a little bit so people have context of what the Venus Project is, and then if that works.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. So you have a research center dedicated to this. What do you do there?
Yes. In 1980, Jacques Fresco and myself, and I'll mention more about him because he actually did the research to, excuse me, to arrive at this direction. So we do many things here. He was a prolific designer. So we came here to build many of the buildings and produce many of the things that he designed. But what we did do are we built 10 buildings of experimental designs. We did them ourselves. I want to mention we had no outside funding at the time. We held outside jobs and didn't take out any mortgages or went into debt. So we built what we could afford to build, not what we wanted to build. But here we wanted to produce educational materials. So we produce our own books. We publish our own books. We made several documentaries that you can find on our YouTube channel. We produced over 400 models of the future because during that time in history, there was no computer animation. So we did it the long, laborious way. We made models to show what the future could be like and what we might be missing. And it deals with everything from transportation to energy to total city systems. It encompasses all aspects of society. We did hundreds of blueprints. Jacques taught me how to do technical illustration to make the models and ultimately make the buildings. And now we also have many drawings and many computer animations also on the future. Oh, and we also hold tours, kind of a tour seminar here every Saturday.
Okay, so one of the things that you focus on a ton is the science of behavior. And that's one of the big things that you stressed in your last documentary. Why is behavior such an important element of what you're focusing on?
Well, we feel what's lacking mostly in society is the understanding of behavior and just how lawful that is. It's just like any other branch of society, of science, but it's mysterious today. We put all sorts of metaphysical claims to it, like instinct, and it's just human nature. And those really try and keep things as they are. It's a convenient scapegoat to not improve things in society and stop things. You know, nothing, when people say that we are one with nature, that has a different meaning to me. Because nothing is self-activating. Everything is acted upon in nature, meaning a plant doesn't grow. It's acted upon by water, by sunlight, by gravity pulling the roots down, by nutrients. If you had a seed and held it in your hand, let me put it this way. If you had a seed and put it in a vacuum, it wouldn't sprout. It might sprout a little bit because of the moisture within the seed, but then it would stop. It needs all those resident forces within the environment acting upon it. And that's the same with anything in nature. A sailboat doesn't sail. It's acted upon by the wind, which is caused by other things in the environment, the clouds. A ball doesn't roll down the hill. It's acted upon because of the center of gravity. It pulls it down the hill. So people are really the same. They're no different than anything else in nature. They're acted upon by their environment. And if you're able to take a child and put him in a gray ball and put no outside stimulus there, keep him alive in some way, then when you took them out at 16, they couldn't speak. They could hardly do anything. So all decisions are really forced upon us by our background. So when you consider whether we're free or not, you know, how free are we with that? You're always influenced by your environment. You're never free. Another example, so you can understand this a little bit better, if you took Beethoven and dropped him as a child in the middle of a jungle where there are headhunters, and you were able to visit him later, first of all, he wouldn't probably be called Beethoven, but he wouldn't develop the music that he would if he was in a different environment. The music he did was influenced by the music that was done at the time. And if you were able to talk to this child as a headhunter, you might go into his hut and be amazed and say, oh my God, you have 10 shrunken heads. And say, my God, don't you feel terrible? And he might say, yes, I do. My uncle has 20. So it really, is he good or bad? Neither. He's just influenced by his environment.
So another example that you gave was with beauty and aesthetics, that beauty in certain cultures, in all different cultures, are appreciated differently. So somebody that we might think is beautiful here is not what somebody in another country might think is beautiful in another culture. And we don't understand that. And that's an example of how it manifests.
Well, people are given all these notions that they think are true and real and go down into history forever. All the notions and the environment that they're raised in, they think it's fixed, but it's not. It's very changeable. And the notion of beauty is another myth like that. Beauty really depends on, like you said, where we live. And, you know, even in my day, what was considered beautiful was Cher. The women tried to emulate Cher, which is thin lips, long ironed hair, flat chest, and it's quite different. The notion of beauty today is quite different. It depends on your geography and it depends on the times. You know, some cultures, they think what is beautiful is to extend your neck with many different rings. And if you took those rings off, the women's head would just fall over because the vertebrae is so stretched. It's terrible. You know, in the old days, they used to bind women's feet, and the smaller the feet, the more beautiful. And the women could hardly walk as they got up in age. So, you know, children would love, if your grandmother, if a child had a grandmother who was toothless with hundreds of wrinkles and a long crooked nose and warts with hair on the warts, and she was nice to the child and taught the child things, the child would hug the grandmother and love the grandmother until somebody comes along and says, ooh, is that your grandmother with that hunched neck and the ugly face? Because they were pumped into their heads what ugly is and what beautiful is. You know, even from Disney characters and Disney movies and all of your movies, they have this notion of beauty. And it hurts many different people. If you're married to somebody that you feel is really, really handsome, the ideal configuration of what you were taught handsomeness was, and you lived with this person for many years, and he abused you and scorned you and put you down in front of others, that face would become ugly to you. And the next time you go to a party and you see somebody with that face or certain aspects of that face, you might say, well, I don't know what it is, but there's something that bothers me about that person. So your notions of beauty are based on your background or what we call associative memory or the things that you've learned from your surroundings. So you can be conditioned to hate any configuration, to hate people who have less, who have more or less melanin in their skin, or who have thin, slanty eyes, or who have red hair or dark hair. The culture pumps all sorts of erroneous, dangerous concepts into your head when you're very young.
It's like the Dr. Seuss book, you know, where they stamp their bellies, and the ones with the stamps on their bellies were the important ones. And then this guy comes with the machine that can stamp bellies, and then suddenly they're the same. And so the other ones had to go back through and get two stamps, and then, you know, it kept going on. It was, it's a child's book, but it's the same concept.
Similar, yeah.
Another thing is in Mexico, and in South American countries, gold on your teeth. Gold on your teeth is a sign of beauty because it shows wealth. Here it's not.
That's right, out of scarcity. And in some cultures, some islands, the women who have very, very long protruding rear ends are considered beautiful. And in some cultures, they pump women full of food. They put them in a cage and feed them because it's considered beautiful if you're heavier, if you're fat.
And a lot of times that's a sign of wealth, right? So that's why it's more beautiful.
And in the old days too, considering, like you said, a sign of wealth, if you had very long fingernails and they turned around, that was considered beautiful, and because the wealthy didn't have to use their hands for labor, and that was admired. So all these concepts, Thorsten Veblen wrote a book about that too, The Theory of the Leisure Class, which was really interesting to see how we got our values. For instance, the veil that people wear sometimes today, not as much anymore, but they did a lot in the past. But it was because one of the queens had smallpox, so they invented a veil, and nobody was supposed to wear the veil until after the queen died, so they all rushed to wear the veil. Same thing with high heels. One of the kings was very short, so they invented heels, and nobody was supposed to wear the heel either until he died. And now we look at it as something reasonable. You know, women wear high heels. They're very bad for your feet. They're good for feet doctors, you know, the foot doctors, but they're not good for your posture, for your feet. A lot of women sprain their ankles with them too. Another thing which I thought was interesting with Veblen, he talked about how we got our customs, as I mentioned. But in the old days, speaking about what you mentioned with the wealth, the more people you had in your hallways just stood there and did nothing, the more admired you were. But they gave them uniforms, and they would wipe their nose on their sleeves. So to counteract that, they would put buttons on their sleeves. And so the remnants of that are the buttons that they have on men's jackets near their wrist.
Interesting. We get these customs from just interesting different ways, but we get so used to it that we don't even think about it. And then it becomes part of our culture, and we only accept that. And if you don't do that, then you're inferior for some reason.
And there are a tremendous amount of artificialities that, as I said, long outlived their usefulness. But we feel you have to look at everything in society and reevaluate it.
Well,
even the social system, which is taboo today to do.
Well, our social systems are not keeping up with the technology that's changing. And that's the problems that we're seeing right now, to the degree that they are. I mean, we've always had problems, but to the degree of problems we have is our social systems are so, they can't keep up, and they need to be redefined just to even deal with our new technology. But one thing that you argue is that genes do not shape your behavior, but rather the environment. So not only do you talk about, you know, the environment as far as shaping us, but you even go down to the genes and explain why genes aren't the source of shaping you. Although there has to be some behavioral differences, because some you'll find in some families, you know, certain behavioral characteristics that is different. Like even if they're raised by a different family, they might still have characteristics like the old family. So genes must have certain, you know, like musically inclined and things like that.
Well, you might be born with the facility to hear more tones, but it still has to be educated. You know, some people have an educated ear or an educated eye to art. I can use the example of art. Anybody, you know, they think that some people have it and some people don't, that some people are talented. Even if you are raised in a family that does not do art, you have to come across it within your environment in some way. For instance, if a child is taken to a beach at an early age and starts to play with the sand and do castles or whatever they do, they develop manual dexterity earlier. And if they go back to the classroom when they're a child, they have a little bit more experience than other people and than the other children. And the teacher might look at this child and think, oh, isn't this child the talented one, and ignore the others. And the teacher doesn't know how to teach art. Art is lawful. And if you learn the laws behind art, you can teach it to anyone. This culture cuts you short when they put the advantages or the blame on genes. You know, when certain people come from this culture, from another culture, you know where they come from by the way they speak, by the accent they have. But after the second and third generation, the kids, if you just heard them, if they have a different facial characteristic, they could tell where their ancestors came. But if you just heard them, you wouldn't be able to know if they came over from the ancestors of the Mayflower, or if you know how long their ancestors have been here. They acclimate to the environment. And in some cultures, that's a problem. They even do honor killing and shame killing because they've taken too much of the new culture. So it really, you're not born with a value system. You're not born with greed or envy or bigotry. That's learned within your culture by the books you read, the movies you see, your role models, to a small degree or to a degree also your parents. But also, you know, everything else that you've encountered. And, you know, even if parents understand this to a limited degree, because if they see their kids playing with somebody that they think would be detrimental, they pull them away and they don't allow them to play with them if they oversee them. So they understand this. And envy, people think, well, you can't change envy. You're born with envy. No, you're not. One example to demonstrate this is what Jock went through. Somebody said, well, every time I feed my cat, my dog growls. That's an inborn trait of jealousy and anger. And so Jacques took the person's cat and the dog, and every time he fed the cat or put it on his lap, Jacques gave the dog some liver. And so every time the cat was given attention, Jacques would feed the dog liver. And after a short time, every time the dog saw Jacques go to reach for the cat, the dog's tail would wag. If that was inborn, you couldn't change that. So even things like envy, again, parents might think that the kids are born envious. One is born envious and the other isn't. But parents not knowing the circumstances of how the environment shapes behavior or what shapes behavior, they cause envy. For an example, you can have two children, a little boy and a little girl, and you tell the little boy, you can't go to the movies, you didn't pick up your toys like your sister did, you didn't do your homework like your sister did. And the little boy becomes envious and jealous. And when he sees the little girl fall down the stairs or break her leg, he gets a slight grin on his face. It's not because he's bad or he's born a bad seed. It's because he feels he's been treated not justly. So those behaviors are generated. They're not handed down by the genes. You know, they used to think that some children can learn how to speak Chinese faster because all their ancestors spoke Chinese. So they actually took a Chinese baby and a British baby and taught them both Chinese at an early age, and they both learned how to speak Chinese at the same rate. So the culture really cuts people short when they put, when they attribute, you know, blame or admiration to the genes.
Well, you also talk about laws, that laws, if they do not fit reality, then they will be violated and people simply won't follow them.
Right, right, true. You know, you can make laws, don't steal. We have tons of laws on the books for not stealing. And you might have taken on those ethics, however you achieve them in society, and you would never think of stealing. But if you lost your job and you lost your ability to buy medical care for your child or feed your child, you might not be inclined to steal for yourself, but you would steal for your child. So it's the circumstances. You could read all the good books on ethics or have all the moral lectures from religion or politics, but the circumstances will really dictate the behavior. You know, when they tell people not to kill the rhinos, people might not want to kill the rhinos, but until you give them a way to feed their family and themselves, then they'll continue to kill the rhinos. It's not their moral ethics that are at play or the laws that need to be written. It's that they are poor and you need to feed them and take care of their needs or enable them to get food and medical care and housing and education for their kids. That's the real problem.
So another thing is that we are much more willing to spend money on war than we are willing to help others, even if it ends up being a fraction of the cost and it'll keep us from going to war.
Sounds logical, doesn't it?
Well, it's ridiculous. So why do we do that?
Because there's lots of money in war, tons of money in war.
But even people who aren't making, even people who don't necessarily benefit from it will accept that.
Well, then they give them notions. They give them words. They pump it into their heads when they're very young. You know, Einstein wrote the preface for a book called Man and His Gods that really described religion from all over the world. And he was against religion. And he stated, what was worse than religion is the notion of patriotism, because it can get you to go and kill other people just for words such as freedom, democracy, you know, pledging allegiance to a flag at an early age creates, you can usurp people. And if you don't teach them critical thinking, then you can use people just like you can use scientists. They have them go to school, they teach them science, but they don't give them a broad education. So they get their kicks out of making weapons, but they don't ask, what are these weapons being used for? Or let's find out the story from the other side of the world. You know, they just
So basically, you can use and manipulate almost anybody if you know what it triggers them, and you keep them ignorant to more than what they're doing. Keep them kind of a sliver view, and then know how what motivates them. I mean, it's terrible, but
well, this is what's being done all the time to perpetuate the system that you live under. All the values that you acquire and that are given to you from a child on up are put into your heads to perpetuate the system that you live under. It's the only way you can control people that way. It's the only way you can get them to fight your wars. The soldiers don't know what they're fighting for. They're, as I mentioned, they go and put up their life for words, patriotism, democracy, freedom, you know, us against them.
How many people are conscious of that and doing it on purpose versus people are just mindlessly going with the culture and going with the status quo?
Well, it serves their interest. It doesn't serve your interests, those in positions of differential advantage, meaning those who have the money to bribe politicians to get the laws enacted to serve their interests. Those who are in the elite class, they don't want anything to rock the boat. They don't want to put themselves, put themselves out of business. They really don't. Even if it would be for their own benefit, they're in a position of advantage and they want to keep that, and they will probably hold on to the very end. So it's a terrible situation. And most of them, you know, everything
goes. You mean that they will die to control their power? Like they'll do it till the end, even if the situation on the other side is better for them and for everyone else. They, because they have so much power, they'll hold on to it at all costs.
Yes, and their positions and their money and the positions of differential advantage, yes, they will. And they perpetuate that. They perpetuate it because of the of your media. They're in control of your media. They're in control of the books and the television and the videos. Internet is our only savior in some aspects, but you know, it was our biggest liberator. But it's really the Venus Project advocates that it is the monetary system itself that causes the problems. Free enterprise, capitalism, the market system, whatever you want to call it, but we refer to it as the monetary system. And as long as you have money in this scenario, you are going to have these problems.
Well, how does that quest for money dehumanize us?
We admire people who have money over knowledge. We admire capitalism. Money is really an interference factor between what you want and what you're able to get. We hold jobs that we don't like to do just because we need money. Money establishes social stratification. We're not equal. They tell people we're equal, but you're not equal without equal purchasing power. And you're as free as your purchasing power in this culture. Laws are enacted that are written by corporations and handed to politicians and put out there word for word, not to serve our interests, but to serve those corporations who write the laws. Goods and are often destroyed just to keep prices up. In this system, all you are, and you're not even embarrassed about it, is a consumer. You have to keep consuming in this system to keep it going. And that's a real problem with technology displacing people. So essentially, we're plundering the planet for resources just to make things we don't need, and we make things to wear out and break down, which is called planned obsolescence, which most of you probably know about.
But which I am tired of needing to buy a new refrigerator or a washer and dryer because they planned that.
Absolutely. Everything is like that. So the scientists really become prostitutes in this system because they're taught well, but they have to go back into the laboratory and make things wear out and break down, usually after the warranty is out. This is deliberate. And another thing is that war is one of our biggest businesses. I don't even have words to say how disgusting it is. So in this system, we have limitless consumption, exploitation, and expansion because of the capitalistic monetary system. When the bottom line is profit and the main aim is wealth, property, and power, you're going to see all the problems that we have today.
Well, it boils down to the values that we have perpetuates the people in power.
That's it, in a nutshell.
And this is everything that we're describing. Well, here's a good example. A small group of bankers own 43% of all assets that are traded, and they pull down 60% of all annual earnings. That's a crazy number. And I don't think people realize that such a small group of people have so much control. And that is also our media is consolidated into 5 media companies, which only 118 directors sit on boards. So essentially, 118 people control all of our media. And I would say even those boards aren't even, those 118 people, a lot of them are just placed if they will just follow along with what a few want you to do.
And the people on those boards are also on other large corporation boards. So it's all intertwined. And, it's come to today where 5 of the wealthiest people own half the amount of wealth as half the population in the world. And people say that the system is broken. The system is doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and it can't be fixed. A new system has to be presented, and this is what's needed.
Well, how do these people also control our government, you know, our democracy, which people say we don't even really live in a democracy or a representative, a republic anymore? But how do they control that?
I would say we never did live in a democracy. In fact, Marx used to say that religion was the opiate of the masses. I seem to think that this word democracy is so abused and so misused. Did anybody ever come to you and ask you to vote for the perpetual wars that we have?
Well, I think this shows when they put the vote out on whether people wanted to go to war in Syria, it was like 96% of the people said no.
But they don't have
it. It didn't matter. We still went to war in Syria. But that shows you how many people do not want to go, yet we're still doing it.
And do they ask you when they want to make a new nuclear power plant? Or do they ask you when they're going to frack under your land that you're supposed to own, but they own the rights underneath the land, so they pollute your water and your land and your air? So public doesn't really have much of a say of anything, so I don't know why they banty around this word democracy. But getting back to your question, also in 2016, industry, not the general public or the people, because they really don't have the money to do this, but they spent over $3.15 billion lobbying the politicians. But today they don't even have to do that in the president's offices. They put industry into office. You can bypass that now. They have taken over. They are controlling things and dismantling whatever they want. And, the money is going from the poor and the middle class to the wealthy faster than any other time in history. So it,
well, and I don't mind certain people, you know, a broad spectrum of people going into office. There should be people from that sector being in there. The problem is we don't get people from the other areas and get a good, it's just certain corporations. And the other thing is smaller companies are being shut out, or they're buying things that are, and a company will come up with a solution that's great for society. The people, you know, it's what our country supposedly is about. An entrepreneur does something, they're probably going to become wealthy and they're disruptive to the whole industry, but it's really good for everybody. A large company swoops and buys it, shelves it, and then shuts it down.
Yes.
And
true.
even if they threaten them behind the scenes, knowing that they're going to, you either let us buy it or you're going nowhere anyways.
They, you know, industries, especially like, I'll give you the example of the oil industry, they put billions into new rigs and searching for oil and bringing it up and distributions and pipelines and everything else. And they don't want anything to disrupt that. They have a long-term investment that they have to get their money back. They have stockholders and everything else. You can't afford to be ethical in this system. You know, if you came up with a food that cleans your teeth better than the toothbrush, the people who make toothbrushes are not going to step aside and say, take it away. This is a much better product. It'll really help people. They put out false claims and false advertisements because they're invested in the culture. They, too, have to send their kids through schools. They have wives that want clothing, and they want different clothing and cars. And, you know, the more you have, the more you have to keep up with other people who have more. So it's a perpetual rat race.
So it's easier to disrupt the smaller areas.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible. Well, I'm not going to say impossible because I know there's a glimpse of possibility here. But it's very difficult to disrupt the big entrenched players. And some of those players really need to be disrupted, because changing our energy system, when we have so many better solutions, it will be so much better for mankind. Now, we could do it and phase it in so it just doesn't completely disrupt. And things are going to be phased in anyways. It's just we have to figure out a way for them not to hold us back and keep us from evolving as man, you know, as a species.
You can't do it in this system. We feel you cannot do it in this system. This is the system that created those processes. So this is the evolution of the monetary or the free enterprise or the capitalistic system. This is it. There is no making it ethical, making it better. It's at its last stages, and its last stages are going to get very ugly. You can't enact laws to override the aspects in society that do not work. You can't slap a law on it and make it work. You can't appeal to people's ethics, because that doesn't work when the society is reinforcing them in so many other ways to do something that is not good for society or people. So the system is dying. We have an established system which holds people back from really producing, manufacturing, and making better products in many ways, and living a more fulfilling lifestyle. It keeps people slaves to the monetary system. You know, in the old days, you used to have slaves, and they used to take care of them and give them food and give them housing. And this is we still have slaves all over the world, but they're paid slavery. When you go into a corporation, it's a dictatorship. You know, they're always talking against dictatorships, but that's a dictatorship. You don't go into the corporation and say, well, what would you like to do? They tell you what you're going to do to serve that corporation. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad or right or wrong, but that is the situation. When you get out, there's no left turn. Don't park here. So it is a dictatorship. But we really need an entirely different system to take care of what you're upset about, because this system does not serve people.
Let's talk about a few more things about this system, and then I want to talk about you, some of your solutions to solving it. Banks pretty much do whatever they want, and then they just pay fines. It's like a do-whatever-you-want and then a fine system. How do we get to that point? And, you know, isn't that pretty much what it is?
Well, banks really run the system. You know, there's so many fallacies of what we think banks do, but they make their own rules. And when we had the mortgage crisis in 2008, they gave trillions back to the bankers, which still got benefits by the millions. And they could have given it back to the people that could pay the banks off, and which would keep the system going, but they didn't, because they don't care about people. It's obvious they wouldn't outsource if they cared about people. So trying to plead for ethics in this system is a hopeless cause. It is the system itself, that with the bankers on the top, that are running the show. And as I said, they're not running it for your interests. They're running it for their interests. All aspects of the banking situation, you know, they might slap a little fine, but it doesn't compare to what the banks made with their criminal behavior compared to the fine that they have to pay. So there is no fixing it. It has to be totally changed.
Well, you also talk about prisons being used as a way of social control. I know we have a mass incarceration problem. I've covered that in a number of shows. But how are they using it for social control?
Well, just one explanation. You know, blacks are imprisoned overwhelmingly more than whites. Blacks don't have the education system, if you're in a poor black, and which most of them live in that area, and they are of no use to the corporations as it is. They contribute very little to the corporations, but they are a use if they imprison them. They get, well, juveniles, they get $116,000 a year. For adults, they get between $30,000 and $40,000 a year, so they're much more profitable to them if they incarcerate them. And if you incarcerate people with trumped-up charges, for those who are what they call social activists or agitators, if they promote something different or they point out very often the problems of society, many of them are imprisoned, if not killed. And this is a good way to keep down revolution, the prison system.
Well, the other thing you talk about is scarcity. You say that scarcity is another way to control society, and you think it's done on purpose. I think there's a lot of mindlessness, you know, like the scientists only learning their thing and then not knowing the whole world. And so I think 90% of the people just see their own sliver, and so they go along with it. Maybe 98% of the people. Do you think that the other small percent are doing things on purpose?
Well, maybe in some aspects when they realize. But I agree. It's the control is so ingrained that we don't even know we're being controlled. Maybe somebody will point out one aspect or another, but they don't understand just whose interest their value system, which means how they think and how they behave, they don't know whose interest the way they think serves.
So it's a byproduct of the interest that you're serving. People might, they're not purposely going out to just hurt people. They're going out because the system is set up that they're going to promote their interests. And as a byproduct of that, that hurts all these people.
They don't care about it. They can't afford to care about it. And you're given a different education in this culture. There's two-tiered education. One tier is you're going to school and you react to bells and you become subservient, you react to times. And the other, for the working class, and the other educational tier is the Harvards and the Yales. And And they're given a value system that they're in a position, they were born to be able to lead where the others can't. And the books that they read reinforce that bigotry and prejudice. And so, you know, it's all self-serving, and it becomes very tight after a while. And I did know, you know, that people, certain industrialists might know in certain areas what they're doing, but like I said, can't afford to be ethical or turn the other cheek. But I did know an industrialist that said he grapples with figuring out just how much money to give his employees, and he had a lot of employees. He was a debt collector, and because at a certain point, they won't come back to work. So he had to keep a minimum type of, although he made a tremendous amount, he did not give his employees very much, so they have to keep coming back to work to pay off their debts.
Because if he gave them too much, they would just quit their jobs? That was his thought?
Yes, they'd go out on vacations. You know, if you paid them any type of equivalent to what the owners get, you know, a small portion of that, but still a good standard of living, they probably wouldn't come back to work.
You have a video that's in your documentary that I want to play, Smedley Butler. He was a soldier in the war, and he really thought deeply about what he was doing. So I want to play that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, he was one of the most decorated Marines after World War I, and he said that he was a gangster for capitalism, essentially. He realized once he wrote a book, War is a Racket, and it was very outspoken after he got out of the military, and of course they tried to shut him up, but he really exposed what the military was about. How they just went into different countries, not to bring democracy, otherwise we'd have democracy all over the world, but to secure resources and cheap labor or pipelines. Excuse me. So he really exposed what he did in different countries, and I think that clip will show it. And his final conclusion was that you can't stop this onslaught of war, because there's so much money to be made in it. And what they do is they have factories that make military munitions and armaments and services to the servicemen. They have factories in every different state, which means the politicians don't want to talk against the military because they would eliminate too many jobs. So, you know, even Sanders didn't talk about the military. So he came to the conclusion that you can't get rid of this through parleys in Geneva or peace conferences. The only way you can get rid of it is taking the money out of war. And we expand that to everything. The only way you can get rid of the detrimental problems, the detrimental behavior, the polluting of the earth, our water, our air, our food, is to take the money out of the scenario.
But how do you do that? How do you take the money out of the scenario and make this all work? So how do you break all this down and replace it with something else that people will be able to embrace and understand?
Well, first of all, we don't advocate you know, throwing bombs at banks or capitalists. It's not really essentially a fight against us and them. It's a fight against the system, the structure of the system itself that needs to be changed. Because quite often when people are deprived and then they become into power, they're just as corrupt as the rest of them. And I would give the example of what's happening to Israel in terms of how much abuse they had. They become abusers. It's well known that children who are abused become abusers as well. So,
well, they get to the point where they think that's the only way that they can maintain their power or control is to abuse others so that they can be in power.
It's because they know of nothing else. And as I mentioned, you can't exceed your environment. You can't think past what the environment gives you. It's a sad thing, but the main thing is you have to educate people to what's going on in society, but mostly what the alternative is, what you can have. Because a lot of liberals complain about society, but they offer no solutions. So you just make people more frustrated. You dump the problems on their laps with no way out, and it makes it harder for people. So unless you replace it with a viable working alternative, is what we do at the Venus Project, then you really go nowhere. You make people more depressed. We get hundreds of letters saying that the Venus Project gives people hope. They see how we can use science and technology for the betterment of people today within an alternative social design, which we'll go into when you want to.
Well, yeah, let's go into that now, because that's, you know, we've kind of addressed most of the problems, although there's lots more, but you've addressed the source of it pretty much. So if you can dive into more how we solve these problems and your research, that's what you're looking at. And we're not talking about socialism or communism or capitalism. It's a different concept altogether.
Right. We're updating our social design based on our new technologies and our new findings. You know, we live the lives of our parents and our great-grandparents with the values that we have. The system is the same of competition and scarcity and money-oriented. But we're advocating something very different. Going back to the old system for a moment, but we feel that competition and scarcity limit progress. But the Venus Project would make all goods and services available to everyone without money, barter, credit, servitude, or trade of any kind. With our technology, if we used our technology wisely, as we advocate, then we could produce, and we gear it toward producing abundance, we could have a fantastic lifestyle. We call it a global resource-based economy, where the aim is creating abundance as quickly as possible with the efficient distribution and production of goods and services that are available to everyone. And we can do this today if we direct science and technology in that way.
How do we deal with certain aspects of society that few want to do that? And then there's certain aspects of society that more, you know, a lot of people want to do. How do we balance those kinds of things out?
Well, I think in education too, but we want to automate remedial jobs as quickly as possible. People don't have to do those types of jobs. You know, many years ago in France, I think it was, nobody wants to clean the toilets. They had automatic toilets in the streets where you go in, you'd use it, you'd come out, it would flush the whole thing down, sanitize it, and be ready for the next person. You can do that all over. You don't need people cleaning the toilets or the bathrooms. But we put scientists on making a better bomb or making a better industrial facility that would outstrip their competitors, or making drones and making oil polluting systems, or, you know, perpetuating what we have but making a better widget for it. And we don't put scientists, we've never given them the problem of how to design a society without booms and busts, with clean sources of energy, where only nutritious food can be grown and served. How do you make cities that are clean and safe? And how do you make safe industrial plants? How do you conserve resources? And much more, but we've never given scientists that problem. We give scientists problems to perpetuate this detrimental, terrible system, insidious system. So that's what's lacking.